sandstone-colored walls. Buses of all kinds, not just Greyhounds, but Trailways, American Pathfinders, Eastern Highways, and Continental Expresses, ringed the terminal with their snouts pushed deep into the loading docks. To Rosie, they looked like fat chrome piglets nursing at an exceedingly ugly mother. She stood outside the main entrance, looking in. The terminal wasn't as crowded as she half hoped, safety in numbers, and half feared. After 14 years of seeing almost no one but her husband and the colleagues he sometimes brought home for a meal, she had developed more than a touch of agoraphobia. Probably because it was the middle of the week and shouting distance from the nearest holiday. Still, she guessed there must be a couple of 100 people in there, walking aimlessly around, sitting on the old-fashioned high-backed wooden benches, playing the video games, drinking coffee in the snack bar, or queuing for tickets. Small children hung onto their mother's hands, tilted their heads back, and bawled like lost calves at the faded logging mural on the ceiling. A loud speaker that echoed like the voice of God in a Cecil B. DeMille Bible epic announced destinations. Erie, Pennsylvania, Nashville, Tennessee, Jackson, Mississippi, Miami, Florida, the disembodied echoing voice pronounced it Miami, Denver, Colorado. Lady, a tired voice said, hey, lady, a little help here, huh? A little help, what do you say? She turned her head and saw a young man with a pale face and a flood of dirty black hair, sitting with his back against one side of the terminal entrance. He was holding a cardboard sign in his lap. Homeless and have AIDS, it read. Please aid me. You got some spare change, don't you? Why, help me out. You'll be riding in your speedboat on Saranac Lake long after I'm dead and gone. What do you say? She felt suddenly strange and faint, on the edge of some mental and emotional overload. The terminal appeared to grow before her eyes until it was as large as a cathedral, and there was something horrifying about the tidal movements of the people in its aisles and alcoves. A man with a wrinkled, pulsing bag of flesh hanging from the side of his neck trudged past her with his head down, dragging a duffel bag after him by its string. The bag hissed like a snake as it slid along the dirty tile floor. A Mickey Mouse doll stuck out of the duffel's top, smiling blandly at her. The godlike announcer was telling the assembled travelers that the Trailways Express to Omaha would be departing gate 17 in 20 minutes. I can't do this, she thought suddenly. I can't live in this world. It isn't just not knowing where the tea bags and scrubbies are. The door he beat me behind was also the door that kept all this confusion and madness out. I can never go back through it again. For a moment, a startlingly vivid image from her childhood Sunday school class filled her mind. Adam and Eve, wearing fig leaves and identical expressions of shame and misery, walking barefoot down a stony path toward a bitter, sterile future. Behind them was the Garden of Eden, lush and filled with flowers. A winged angel stood before its closed gate, the sword in its hand glowing with terrible light. "Don't you dare think of it that way," she cried suddenly, and the man sitting in the doorway recoiled so strongly that he almost dropped his sign. "Don't you dare!" "Jesus, I'm sorry," the man with the sign said and rolled his eyes. "Go on, if that's the way you feel." "No, it wasn't you. I was thinking about my..." The absurdity of what she was doing, trying to explain herself to a beggar sitting in the doorway of the bus terminal, came home to her then. She was still holding $2 in her hand, her change from the cabbie. She flung them into the cigar box beside the young man with a sign and fled into the portside terminal. Another young man, this one with a tiny Errol Flynn mustache and a handsome, unreliable face, had set up a game she recognized from TV shows as three-card Monty on top of his suitcase near the back of the terminal. "Find the ace of spades," he invited. "Find the ace of spades, lady?" In her mind, she saw a fist floating toward her, saw a ring on the third finger, a ring with the words service, loyalty, and community engraved on it. "No, thank you," she said. "I never had a problem with that." His expression as she passed suggested he thought she had a few bats flying around loose in her belfry, but that was all right. He was not her problem. Neither was the man at the entrance who might or might not have AIDS, or the man with a bag of flesh hanging from his neck and the Mickey Mouse doll poking out of his duffel. Her problem was Rose Daniels. Check that. Rosie McClendon. And that was her only problem. She started down the center aisle, then stopped as she saw a trash barrel. A curt imperative, "Don't litter," was stenciled across its round green belly. She opened her purse, took out the ATM card, gazed down at it for a moment, then pushed it through the flap on top of the barrel. She hated to let it go, but at the same time she was relieved to see the last of it. If she kept it, using it again might become a temptation she couldn't resist. And Norman wasn't stupid. Brutal, yes. Stupid, no. If she gave him a way to trace her, he would. She would do well to keep that in mind. She took in a deep breath, held it for a second or two, then let it out and headed for the arrivals-departures monitors clustered at the center of the building. She didn't look back. If she had, she would have seen the young man with the Errol Flynn mustache already rummaging in the barrel, looking for whatever it was the ditzy lady in the sunglasses and bright red kerchief had 86'd. To the young man, it had looked like a credit card. Probably not. But you never knew stuff like that for sure unless you checked. And sometimes the person got lucky. Sometimes. Hell, often. They didn't call it the land of opportunity for nothing. The next large city to the west was only 250 miles away, and that felt too close. She decided on an even bigger one, 550 miles farther on. It was a lakeshore city like this one, but in the next time zone. There was a Continental Express headed there in half an hour. She went to the bank of ticket windows and got into line. Her heart was thumping hard in her chest and her mouth was dry. Just before the person in front of her finished his transaction and moved away from the window, she put the back of her hand to her mouth and stifled a burp that burned coming up and tasted of her morning coffee. "You don't dare use either version of your name here," she cautioned herself. "If they want a name, you have to give another one." "Help you, ma'am?" the clerk asked, looking at her over a pair of half-glasses perched precariously on the end of his nose. "Angela Flight," she said. It was the name of her best chum in junior high school, and the last friend she had ever really made. At Aubreyville High School, Rosie had gone steady with the boy who had married her a week after her graduation, and they had formed a country of two, one whose borders were usually closed to tourists. "Beg your pardon, ma'am?" She realized she had named a person rather than a place, and how odd, this guy's probably looking at my wrists and neck trying to see if the straitjacket left any marks, it must have sounded. She blushed in confusion and embarrassment and made an effort to clutch at her thoughts to put them in some kind of order. "I'm sorry," she said, and a dismal premonition came to her. Whatever else the future might hold, that simple, rueful little phrase was going to follow her like a tin can tied to a stray dog's tail. There had been a closed door between her and most of the world for 14 years, and right now she felt like a terrified mouse who has misplaced its hole in the kitchen baseboard. The clerk was still looking at her, and the eyes above the amusing half-glasses were now rather impatient. "Can I help you or not, ma'am?"
"Yes, please. I want to buy a ticket on the 11:05 bus. Are there still some seats on that one?"
"Oh, I guess about 40. One way or round trip?"
"One way," she said, and felt another flush warm her cheeks as the enormity of what she was saying came home to her.
She tried to smile and said it again with a little more force. "One way, please." "That's $59.70," he said. And she felt her knees grow weak with relief. She had been expecting a much higher fare, had even been prepared for the possibility that he would ask for most of what she had.
"Thank you," she said, and he must have heard the honest gratitude in her voice, because he looked up from the form he was drawing to him and smiled at her. The impatient, guarded look had left his eyes.
"A pleasure," he said. "Luggage, ma'am?"
I don't have any luggage," she said, and was suddenly afraid of his gaze. She tried to think of an explanation. Surely it must sound suspicious to him, an unaccompanied woman headed for a far-off city with no luggage except her purse. But no explanation came. And she saw that was all right. He wasn't suspicious, wasn't even curious. He simply nodded and began to write up her ticket. She had a sudden and far from pleasant realization. She was no novelty at Portside. This man saw women like her all the time, women hiding behind dark glasses, women buying tickets to different time zones, women who looked as if they had forgotten who they were somewhere along the way, and what they thought they were doing, and why. Rosie felt a profound sense of relief as the bus lumbered out of the Portside terminal on time, turned left, recrossed the Trunkatawny, and then got on I-78 heading west. As they passed the last of the three downtown exits, she saw the triangular glass-sided building that was the new police headquarters. It occurred to her that her husband might be behind one of those big windows right now, that he might even be looking out at this big, shiny bus beetling along the interstate. She closed her eyes and counted to 100. When she opened them again, the building was gone. Gone forever, she hoped. She had taken a seat three-quarters of the way back in the bus, and the diesel engine hummed steadily not far behind her. She closed her eyes again and rested the side of her face on the window. She would not sleep, she was too keyed up to sleep, but she could rest. She had an idea she was going to need all the rest she could get. She was still amazed at how suddenly this had happened, an event more like a heart attack or a stroke than a change of life. Change? That was putting it mildly. She hadn't just changed it, she had uprooted it, like a woman tearing an African violet out of its pot. Change of life, indeed. No, she would never sleep. Sleep was out of the question. And so thinking, she slipped not into sleep, but into that umbilical cord which connects sleeping and waking. Here she moved slowly back and forth like a bubble, faintly aware of the diesel engine's steady hum, the sound of the tires on the pavement, of a kid 4 or 5 rows up asking his mother when they were going to get to Aunt Norma's. But she was also aware that she had become untethered from herself, and that her mind had opened like a flower, a rose, of course, opened as it does only when one is in neither one place nor the other. I'm going to sleep after all, she thought. I think I really am. Imagine that. Her nose, her entire head, was filled with smells of summer, so sweet and so strong that they were almost overwhelming. Chief among them was the smell of honeysuckle, drifts of it. She could hear crickets, and when she looked up, she saw the polished bone face of the moon riding high overhead. Its white glow was everywhere, turning the mist rising from the tangled grasses around her bare legs to smoke. She raised her hands with the fingers splayed and the thumbs almost touching. She framed the moon like a picture, and as the night wind stroked her bare arms, she felt her heart first swell with happiness and then contract with fright. She sensed a dozing savagery in this place, as if there might be animals with big teeth loose in the perfumed undergrowth. Rose, come over here, sweetheart. I want to talk to you. Up close. She turned her head and saw his fist rushing out of the dark. Icy strokes of moonlight gleamed on the raised letters of his police academy ring. She saw the stressful grimace of his lips pull back in something like a smile, and jerked awake in her seat, gasping, her forehead damp with sweat. She must have been breathing hard for some time because her window was humid with her condensed breath, almost completely fogged in. She swiped a clear patch on the glass with the side of her hand and looked out. The city was almost gone now. They were passing an ex-urban litter of gas stations and fast food franchises, but behind them she could see stretches of open field. I've gotten away from him, she thought. No matter what happens to me now, I've gotten away from him. Even if I have to sleep in doorways or under bridges, I've gotten away from him. He'll never hit me again because I've gotten away from him. But she discovered she did not entirely believe it. He would be furious with her, and he would try to find her. She was sure of it. But how can he? I've covered my trail. I didn't even have to write down my old school chum's name in order to get my ticket. I threw away the bank card. That's the biggest thing. So how can he find me? She didn't know exactly, but finding people was what he did, and she would have to be very, very careful. What she felt like was a tiny speck of flotsam in the middle of a trackless ocean. The terror which had filled her near the end of her brief dream was still with her, but so were traces of the exhilaration and happiness, a sense of being, if not powerful, at least free. She leaned against the high-backed bus seat and watched the last of the fast-food restaurants and muffler shops fall away. Now it was just the countryside, newly opened fields and belts of trees that were turning that fabulous cloudy green that belongs only to April. She watched them roll past with her hands clasped loosely in her lap and let the big silver bus take her on toward whatever lay ahead. Kindness of Strangers. She had a great many bad moments during the first weeks of her new life, but even at what was very nearly the worst of them all, getting off the bus at 3 a.m. and entering a terminal 4 times the size of Portside, she did not regret her decision. She was, however, terrified. Rosie stood just inside the doorway of Gate 62, clutching her purse tightly in both hands and looking around with wide eyes as people rushed past in riptides, some dragging suitcases, some balancing string-tied cardboard boxes on their shoulders, some with their arms around the shoulders of their girlfriends or the waists of their boyfriends. As she watched, a man sprinted toward a woman who had just gotten off Rosie's bus, seized her and spun her around so violently that her feet left the ground. The woman crowed with delight and terror, her cry as bright as a flash gun in the crowded, confused terminal. There was a bank of video games to Rosie's right, and although it was the darkest hour of the morning, kids, most with their baseball caps turned round backward and at least 80% of their hair buzzed off, were bellied up to all of them. "Try again, Space Cadet," the one nearest to Rosie invited in a grinding, inhuman voice. "Try again, Space Cadet. Try again, Space Cadet." She walked slowly past the video games and into the terminal, sure of only one thing. She didn't dare go out at this hour of the morning. She felt the chances were excellent that she would be raped, killed, and stuffed into the nearest garbage can if she did. She glanced left and saw a pair of uniformed policemen coming down the escalator from the upper level. One was twirling his nightstick in a complex pattern. The other was grinning in a hard, humorless way that made her think of a man 800 miles behind her. He grinned, but there was no grin in his constantly moving eyes. What if their job is to tour the place every hour or so and kick out everyone who doesn't have a ticket? What will you do then? She'd handle that if it came up. That was what she'd do. For the time being, she moved away from the escalator and toward an alcove where a dozen or so travelers were parked in hard plastic contour chairs. Small coin-op TVs were bolted to the arms of these chairs. Rosie kept an eye on the cops as she went and was relieved to see them move across the floor of the terminal and away from her. In 2.5 hours, 3 at the most, it would be daylight. After that, they could catch her and kick her out. Until then, she wanted to stay right here, where there were lights and lots of people. She sat down in one of the TV chairs. 2 seats away on her left, a girl wearing a faded denim jacket and holding a backpack on her lap was dozing. Her eyes rolled beneath her purple-tinted eyelids, and a long, silvery strand of saliva depended from her lower lip. 4 words had been tattooed on the back of her right hand, straggling blue capitals that announced, "I love my honey." "Where's your honey now, sweetheart?" Rosie thought. She looked at the blank screen of the TV, then at the tiled wall on her right. Here, someone had scrawled the words, "Suck my AIDS-infected cock," in red magic marker. She looked away hastily, as if the words would burn her retinas if she looked at them too long, and gazed across the terminal. On the far wall was a huge lighted clock. It was 3:16 a.m. 2.5 more hours and I can leave, she thought, and began to wait them through. She'd had a cheeseburger and a lemonade when the bus made a rest stop around 6 o'clock the previous evening. Nothing since then, and she was hungry. She sat in the TV alcove until the hands of the big clock made it around to 4 a.m., then decided she'd better get a bite. She crossed to the small cafeteria near the ticket windows, stepping over several sleeping people on her way. Many of them had their arms curled protectively around bulging, tape-mended plastic garbage bags, and by the time Rosie got coffee and juice and a bowl of Special K, she understood that she had been needlessly worried about being kicked out by the cops. These sleepers weren't through travelers. They were homeless people camping out in the bus terminal. Rosie felt sorry for them, but she also felt perversely comforted. It was good to know that there would be a place for her tomorrow night, if she really needed one. And if he comes here to this city, where do you think he'll check first? What do you think will be his very first stop? Well, that was silly. He wasn't going to find her. There was absolutely no way he could find her. But the thought still sent a cold finger up her back, tracing the curve of her spine. The food made her feel better, stronger, and more awake. When she had finished, lingering over her coffee until she saw the Chicano busboy looking at her with unconcealed impatience, she started slowly back to the TV alcove. On the way, she caught sight of a blue and white circle over a booth near the rental car kiosks. The words bending their way around the circle's blue outer stripe were, "Traveler's Aid." And Rosie thought, not without a twinkle of humor, that if there had ever been a traveler in the history of the world who needed aid, it was her. She took a step toward the lighted circle. There was a man sitting inside the booth under it, she saw, a middle-aged guy with thinning hair and horn-rimmed glasses. He was reading a newspaper. She took another step in his direction and stopped again. She wasn't really going over there, was she? What in God's name would she tell him? That she had left her husband? That she had gone with nothing but her purse, his ATM card, and the clothes she stood up in? Why not? Practical Sensible asked, and the total lack of sympathy in her voice struck Rosie like a slap. If you had the guts to leave him in the first place, don't you have the guts to own up to it? She didn't know if she did or not, but she knew that telling a stranger the central fact of her life at 4 o'clock in the morning would be very difficult. And probably he'd just tell me to get lost anyway. Probably his job is helping people to replace their lost tickets or making lost children announcements over the loudspeakers. But her feet started moving in the direction of the Traveler's Aid booth just the same, and she understood that she did mean to speak to the stranger with the thinning hair and the horn-rimmed glasses, and that she was going to do it for the simplest reason in the universe. She had no other choice. In the days ahead, she would probably have to tell a lot of people that she had left her husband, that she had lived in a daze behind a closed door for 14 years, that she had damned few life skills and no work skills at all, that she needed help, that she needed to depend on the kindness of strangers. But none of that is really my fault, is it? She thought. And her own calmness surprised her, almost stunned her. She came to the booth and put the hand not currently clutching the strap of her purse on the counter. She looked hopefully and fearfully down at the bent head of the man in the horn-rimmed glasses, looking at his brown, freckled skull through the strands of hair laid across it in neat, thin rows. She waited for him to look up, but he was absorbed in his paper, which was written in a foreign language that looked like either Greek or Russian. He carefully turned a page and frowned at a picture of two soccer players tussling over a ball. "Excuse me," she asked in a small voice, and the man in the booth raised his head. "Please let his eyes be kind," she thought suddenly. "Even if he can't do anything, please let his eyes be kind. And let them see me, the real person who is standing here with nothing but the strap of this Kmart purse to hold on to." And she saw his eyes were kind, weak and swimmy behind the thick lenses of his glasses, but kind. "I'm sorry, but can you help me?" she asked. The Traveler's Aid volunteer introduced himself as Peter Slowick, and he listened to Rosie's story in attentive silence. She told as much as she could, having already come to the conclusion that she could not depend on the kindness of strangers if she held what was true about her in reserve, out of either pride or shame. The only important thing she didn't tell him, because she couldn't think of a way to express it, was how unarmed she felt, how totally unprepared for the world. Until the last 18 hours or so, she'd had no conception of how much of the world she only knew from TV or from the daily paper her husband brought home. "I understand that you left on the spur of the moment," Mr. Slowick said. "But while you were riding the bus, did you have any ideas about what you would do or where you should go when you got here? Any ideas at all?"
"I thought I might be able to find a woman's hotel to start with," she said. "Are there still such places?"
"Yes, at least three that I know of, but the cheapest has rates that would probably leave you broke in a week. They're hotels for well-to-do ladies, for the most part, ladies who come to spend a week in the city, touring the shops or visiting relatives who don't have room to put them up."
"Oh," she said. "Well, then, what about the YWCA?
Mr. Slowick shook his head. "They closed down the last of their boarding facilities in 1990. They were being overrun by crazy people and drug addicts."
She felt a touch of panic, then made herself think of the people who slept here on the floor with their arms around their taped garbage bags of possessions. "There's always that," she thought. "Do you have any ideas?" she asked.
He looked at her for a moment, tapping his lower lip with the barrel of a ballpoint pen, a plain-faced little man with watery eyes who had nevertheless seen her and spoken to her, who hadn't just told her to get lost.
And, of course, he didn't tell me to lean forward so he could talk to me up close, she thought.
Slowick seemed to come to a decision. He opened his coat, an off-the-rack polyester that had seen better days, felt around in his inside pocket, and brought out a business card. On the side where his name and the Traveler's Aid logo were displayed, he carefully printed an address. Then he turned the card over and signed the blank side, writing in letters that struck her as comically large. His oversized signature made her think of something her American history teacher had told her class back in high school about why John Hancock had written his name in especially large letters on the Declaration of Independence. "So King George can read it without his spectacles," Hancock was supposed to have said. "Can you make out the address?" he asked, handing her the card.
"Yes," she said. 251 Durham Avenue.
"Good. Put the card in your purse and don't lose it. Someone will probably want to look at it when you get there. I'm sending you to a place called Daughters and Sisters. It's a shelter for battered women. Rather unique. Based on your story, I'd say you qualify."
"How long will they let me stay?"
He shrugged. "I believe that varies from case to case."
"So that's what I am now," she thought. "A case."
He seemed to read her thought because he smiled. There was nothing very lovely about the teeth, the smile revealed, but it looked honest enough. He patted her hand. It was a quick touch, awkward and a bit timid. "If your husband beat you as badly as you say, Miss McClendon, you've bettered your situation wherever you end up."
"Yes," she said. "I think so, too.
And if all else fails, there's always the floor here, isn't there?" He looked taken aback. "Oh, I don't think it'll come to that."
"It might. It could."
She nodded at two of the homeless people sleeping side by side on their spread coats at the end of a bench. One of them had a dirty orange cap pulled down over his face to block out the relentless light. Slowick looked at them for a moment, then back at her. "It won't come to that," he repeated, this time sounding more sure of himself. "The city buses stop right outside the main doors. Turn to your left, and you'll see where. Various parts of the curb are painted to correspond with various bus routes. You want an orange line bus, so you'll stand on the orange part of the curb. Understand?"
"Yes."
"It costs a buck, and the driver will want exact change. He's apt to be impatient with you if you don't have it."
"I've got plenty of change."
"Good. Get off at the corner of Dearborn and Elk, then walk up Elk 2 blocks, or maybe it's 3. I can't remember for sure. Anyway, you'll come to Durham Avenue. You'll want to make a left. It's about 4 blocks up, but they're short blocks. A big white frame house. I'd tell you it looks like it needs to be repainted, but they might have gotten around to that by now. Can you remember all that?
Yes.
One more thing. Stay in the bus terminal until it's daylight. Don't go out anywhere, not even to the city bus stop, until then.
I wasn't planning to, she said.
She had gotten only 2 or 3 hours' worth of broken sleep on the Continental Express, which had brought her here, and so what happened after she stepped off the Orange Line bus really wasn't surprising. She got lost. Rosie decided later that she must have started by going the wrong way on Elk Street, but the result, almost 3 hours of wandering in a strange neighborhood, was much more important than the reason. She trudged around block after block, looking for Durham Avenue and not finding it. Her feet hurt, her lower back throbbed, she began to get a headache, and there were certainly no Peter Slowicks in this neighborhood. The faces, which did not ignore her completely, regarded her with mistrust, suspicion, or outright disdain. Not long after getting off the bus, she passed a dirty, secretive-looking bar called the Wee Nip. The shades were down, the beer signs were dark, and a grate had been pulled across the door. When she came back to the same bar some 20 minutes later, not realizing she was recovering ground she'd already walked until she saw it, the houses all looked the same. The shades were still down, but the beer signs were on and the grate had been rolled back. A man in chino work clothes leaned in the doorway with a half-empty beer stein in his hand. She looked at her watch and saw it was not quite 6:30 in the morning. Rosie lowered her head until she could see the man only from the corner of one eye, held the strap of her purse a little tighter, and walked a little faster. She guessed the man in the doorway would know where Durham Avenue was, but she had no intention of asking him for directions. He had the look of a guy who liked to talk to people, women especially, up close.
Hey, baby," he said as she passed the Wee Nip.
His voice was absolutely uninflected, almost the voice of a robot. And although she didn't want to look at him, she couldn't help shooting a single terrified glance back at him over her shoulder. He had a receding hairline, pale skin on which a number of blemishes stood out like partially healed burns, and a dark red walrus mustache that made her think of David Crosby. There were little dots of beer foam in it.
"Hey, baby, want to get it on? You don't look too bad. Pretty good, in fact. Nice tits. What do you say? Want to get it on? Do some low riding? Want to get it on? Want to do the dog? What do you say?"
She turned away from him and forced herself to walk at a steady pace, her head now bent like a Muslim woman on her way to market. Forced herself not to acknowledge him further in any way. If she did that, he might come after her.
"Hey, baby, let's put all four on the floor. What do you say? Let's get down. Let's do the dog. Let's get it on. Let's get it on. Get it on."
She turned the corner and let out a long breath that pulsed like a living thing with the frantic, frightened beat of her heart. Until that moment, she hadn't missed her old town or neighborhood in the slightest. But now her fear of the man in the bar doorway and her disorientation. Why did all the houses have to look so much the same? Why? Combined in a feeling that was close to homesickness. She had never felt so horribly alone, or so convinced that things were going to turn out badly. It occurred to her that perhaps she would never escape this nightmare, that perhaps this was just a preview of what the rest of her life was going to be like. She even began to speculate that there was no Durham Avenue, that Mr. Slowick, in Traveler's Aid, who had seemed so nice, was actually a sadistic sicko who delighted in turning people who were already lost even further around. At 8:15 by her watch, long after the sun had come up on what promised to be an unseasonably hot day, she approached a fat woman in a house dress who was at the foot of her driveway, loading empty garbage cans onto a dolly with slow, stylized movements. Rosie took off her sunglasses.
"Beg pardon?"
The woman wheeled around at once. Her head was lowered, and she wore the truculent expression of a lady who has frequently been called Fatty Fatty 2x4 from across the street, or perhaps from passing cars.
"What you want?"
"I'm looking for 251 Durham Avenue," Rosie said. "It's a place called Daughters and Sisters. I had directions, but I guess..."
"What, the welfare lesbians?" You asked the wrong chicken, baby girl. I got no use for crack snackers. Get lost. The fuck out of here.
With that, she turned back to her dolly and began to push the rattling cans up the driveway in the same slow, ceremonial manner, holding them on with one plump, white hand. Her buttocks jiggled freely beneath her faded house dress. When she reached the step, she turned round and looked back at the sidewalk.
Didn't you hear me? Get the fuck out of here, before I call the cops.
That last word felt like a sharp pinch in a sensitive place. Rosie put her sunglasses back on and walked quickly away. Cops? No, thank you. She wanted nothing to do with the cops, any cops. But after she had put a little distance between herself and the fat lady, Rosie realized she actually felt a little better. She had at least made sure that daughters and sisters, known in some quarters as the welfare lesbians, actually existed, and that was a step in the right direction. Two blocks farther down, she came to a mom-and-pop store with a bike rack in front and a sign reading, Oven Fresh Rolls, in the window. She went in, bought a roll. It was still warm and made Rosie think of her mother, and asked the old man behind the counter if he could direct her to Durham Avenue.
You come a little out of your way, he said.
Oh, how much?
2 mile or so. Come here.
He settled a bony hand on her shoulder, led her back to the door, and pointed to a busy intersection only a block away.
That there is Dearborn Avenue.
Oh, God, is it? Rosie wasn't sure if she needed to laugh or cry.
Yes'm. Only trouble with finding things by way of Big D is that she run most way across the city. You see that shut-down movie theater?
Yes.
You want to turn right onto Dearborn there. You have to go 16, 18 blocks. It's a bit of a heel and toe. You best take the bus.
I suppose, Rosie said, knowing she wouldn't. Her quarters were gone, and if a bus driver gave her a hard time about breaking a dollar bill, she would burst into tears. The thought that the man she was talking to would have happily given her change for a buck never crossed her tired, confused mind.
Eventually you'll come to
Elk Street. He gave her a look of exasperation.
Lady, if you knew how to go, why'd you ask?
I didn't know how to go, she said, and although there had been nothing particularly unkind in the old man's voice, she could feel the tears threatening. I don't know anything. I've been wandering around for hours. I'm tired and...
Okay, okay, he said. That's all right. Don't get your water hot. You'll be just fine. I get off the bus at Elk. Durham is just 2 or 3 blocks up. Easy as pie.
You got a street address? She nodded her head.
All right, there you go, he said. Should be no problem.
Thank you. He pulled a wrinkled but clean handkerchief from his back pocket. He held it out to her with one gnarled hand.
Wipe your face a little bit, dear, he said. You leakin'.
She walked slowly up Dearborn Avenue, barely noticing the buses that snored past her, resting every block or two on bus stop benches. Her headache, which had come mostly from the stress of being lost, was gone, but her feet and back hurt worse than ever. It took her an hour to get to Elk Street. She turned right on it and asked the first person she saw, a young pregnant woman, if she was headed toward Durham Avenue.
Buzz off,
the young pregnant woman said, her face so instantly wrathful that Rosie took 2 steps backward. I'm sorry, Rosie said.
Sorry, Shmari, who asked you to speak to me in the first place? That's what I'd like to know. Get out of my way.
And she pushed by Rosie so violently she almost knocked her into the gutter. Rosie watched her go with a kind of stupefied amazement, then turned and went on her way. She walked more slowly than ever up Elk, a street of small shops, dry-cleaning establishments, florists, delis with fruit displays out front on the sidewalk, stationers. She was now so tired she didn't know how long she would be able to remain on her feet, let alone keep walking. She felt a lift when she came to Durham Avenue, but it was only temporary. Had Mr. Slowick told her to turn right or left on Durham? She couldn't remember. She tried right and found the numbers going up from the mid-400s. Par for the course, she muttered and turned around again. 10 minutes later, she was standing in front of a very large white frame house, which was indeed in serious need of paint, 3 stories high and set back behind a big, well-kept lawn. The shades were pulled. There were wicker chairs on the porch, almost a dozen of them, but none was currently occupied. There was no sign reading daughters and sisters, but the street number on the column to the left of the steps leading to the porch was 251. She made her way slowly up the flagged walk and then the steps, her purse now hanging at her side.
"They're going to send you away," a voice whispered. "They'll send you away. Then you can head on back to the bus station. You'll want to get there early so you can stake out a nice piece of floor."
The doorbell had been covered over with layers of electrician's tape, and the keyhole had been plugged with metal. To the left of the door was a key card slot that looked brand new, and an intercom box above it. Below the box was a small sign which read, "Visitors, press and speak." Rosie pressed. In the course of her long morning's tramp, she had rehearsed several things she might say, several ways she might introduce herself. But now that she was actually here, even the least clever and most straightforward of her possible opening gambits had gone out of her head. Her mind was a total blank. She simply let go of the button and waited. The seconds passed, each one like a little chunk of lead. She was reaching for the button again when a woman's voice came out of the speaker. It sounded tinny and emotionless. "Can I help you?" Although the man with the mustache outside the wee nip had frightened her, and the pregnant woman had amazed her, neither had made her cry. Now, at the sound of this voice, the tears came. There was nothing at all she could do to stop them.
"I hope someone can," Rosie said, wiping at her cheeks with her free hand. "I'm sorry, but I'm in the city all by myself. I don't know anyone, and I need a place to stay. If you're full, I understand, but could I at least come in and sit for a while and maybe have a glass of water?"
There was more silence. Rosie was reaching for the button again when the tinny voice asked who had sent her.
"The man in the traveler's aid booth at the bus station, David Slowick?"
She thought that over, then shook her head.
"No, that's wrong. Peter. His name was Peter, not David."
"Did he give you a business card?" the tinny voice asked.
"Yes."
"Please find it." She opened her purse and rummaged for what felt like hours. Just as fresh tears began to prick at her eyes and double her vision, she happened on the card. It had been hiding beneath a wad of Kleenex.
"I have it," she said. "Do you want me to put it through the letter slot?"
"No," the voice said. "There's a camera right over your head." She looked up, startled. There was indeed a camera mounted over the door and looking down at her with its round black eye. "Hold it up to the camera, please. Not the front, but the back." As she did so, she remembered the way Slowick had signed the business card, making his signature as large as he possibly could. Now she understood why. "Okay," the voice said. "I'm going to buzz you inside."
"Thanks," Rosie said.
She used the Kleenex to wipe at her cheeks, but it did no good. She was crying harder than ever, and she couldn't seem to stop. That evening, as Norman Daniels lay on the sofa in his living room, looking up at the ceiling and already thinking of how he might begin the job of finding the bitch. A break, he thought. "I need a break to start with. Just a little one would probably be enough." His wife was being taken to meet Anna Stevenson. By then, Rosie felt a strange but welcome calm, the sort of calm one might feel in a recognized dream. She half believed she was dreaming. She had been given a late breakfast, or perhaps it had been an early lunch, and then taken to one of the downstairs bedrooms where she had slept like a stone for 6 hours. Then, before being shown into Anna's study, she had been fed again, roast chicken, mashed potatoes, peas. She had eaten guiltily but hugely, unable to shake the idea that it was non-caloric dream food she was stuffing herself with. She finished with a goblet of Jell-O in which bits of canned fruit floated like bugs in amber. She was aware that the other women at the table were looking at her, but their curiosity seemed friendly. They talked, but Rosie could not follow their conversations. Somebody mentioned the Indigo Girls, and she at least knew who they were. She had seen them once on Austin City Limits while waiting for Norman to come home from work. While they ate their Jell-O desserts, one of the women put on a Little Richard record, and two other women danced the jitterbug, popping their hips and twirling. There was laughter and applause. Rosie looked at the dancers with a numb absence of interest, wondering if they were welfare lesbians. Later, when the table was cleared, Rosie tried to help, but they wouldn't let her.
"Come on," one of the women said.
Rosie thought her name was Consuela. She had a wide, disfiguring scar under her left eye and down her left cheek.
"Anna wants to meet you."
"Who's Anna?"
"Anna Stevenson," Consuela said as she led Rosie down a short hall which opened off the kitchen. "Boss lady."
"What's she like?"
"You'll see."
Consuela opened the door of a room which had probably once been the pantry, but made no move to go in. The room was dominated by the most fabulously cluttered desk Rosie had ever seen. The woman who sat behind it was a bit stout, but undeniably handsome. With her short but carefully dressed white hair, she reminded Rosie of Beatrice Arthur, who had played Maud on the old TV sitcom. The severe white blouse, black jumper combination accentuated the resemblance even further, and Rosie approached the desk timidly. She was more than half convinced that now that she had been fed and allowed a few hours' sleep, she would be turned out onto the street again. She told herself not to argue or plead if that happened. It was their place, after all, and she was already two meals to the good. She wouldn't have to stake out a piece of bus station floor either, at least not yet. She still had money enough for several nights in a cheap hotel or motel. Things could be worse. A lot worse. She knew that was true. But the woman's crisp demeanor and direct blue eyes, eyes that must have seen hundreds of Rosies come and go over the years, still intimidated her.
"Sit down," Anna invited.
And when Rosie was seated in the room's only other chair, she had to remove a stack of papers from the seat and put them on the floor beside her. The nearest shelf was full. Anna introduced herself and then asked Rosie for her name.
"I guess it's actually Rose Daniels," she said, "but I've gone back to McClendon, my maiden name. I suppose that isn't legal, but I don't want to use my husband's name anymore. He beat me, and so I left him."
She realized that sounded as if she'd left him the first time he'd done it, and her hand went to her nose, which was still a little tender up where the bridge ended.
"We were married a long time before I got up the courage, though."
"How long a time are we talking about?"
14 years.
Rosie discovered she could no longer meet Anna Stevenson's direct blue gaze. She dropped her eyes to her hands, which were knotted so tightly together in her lap that the knuckles were white.
"Now she'll ask me why it took me so long to wake up," she thought. "She won't ask me if maybe some sick part of me liked getting beaten up, but she'll think it." Instead of asking why about anything, the woman asked how long Rosie had been gone.
It was a question she found she had to consider carefully, and not just because she was now on Central Standard Time. The hours on the bus, combined with the unaccustomed stretch of sleep in the middle of the day, had disoriented her time sense.
"About 36 hours,
she said after a bit of mental calculation.
"Give or take."
"Uh-huh."
Rosie kept expecting forms which Anna would either hand to Rosie or start filling in herself, but the woman only went on looking at her over the strenuous topography of her desk. It was unnerving.
"Now tell me about it. Tell me everything."
Rosie drew a deep breath and told Anna about the drop of blood on the sheet. She didn't want to give Anna the idea that she was so lazy or so crazy, that she had left her husband of 14 years because she didn't want to change the bed linen, but she was terribly afraid that that was how it must sound. She wasn't able to explain the complex feelings that spot had aroused in her, and she wasn't able to admit to the anger she had felt, anger which had seemed simultaneously new and like an old friend. But she did tell Anna that she had rocked so hard she had been afraid she might break Pooh's chair.
"That's what I call my rocker," she said, blushing so hard that her cheeks felt as if they might be on the verge of smoking. "I know, it's stupid."
Anna Stevenson waved it off. "What did you do after you made your mind up to go? Tell me that." Rosie told her about the ATM card and how she had been sure that Norman would have a hunch about what she was doing and either call or come home. She couldn't bring herself to tell this severely handsome woman that she had been so scared she'd gone into someone's backyard to pee, but she told about using the ATM card and how much she'd drawn out and how she'd come to the city because it seemed far enough away and the bus would be leaving soon. The words came out of her in bursts, surrounded by periods of silence, in which she tried to think of what to say next,
and contemplated with amazement and near disbelief what she had done.
She finished by telling Anna about how she'd gotten lost that morning and showing her Peter Slowick's card. Anna handed it back after a single quick glance.
"Do you know him very well?" Rosie asked. "Mr. Slowick."
Anna smiled. To Rosie, it looked like it had a bitter edge. "Oh, yes," she said. "He is a friend of mine, an old friend. Indeed he is. And a friend of women like you as well."
"Anyway, I finally got here," Rosie finished. "I don't know what comes next, but at least I got this far."
A ghost of a smile touched the corners of Anna Stevenson's mouth. "Yes, and made a good job of it, too." Gathering all her remaining courage, the last 36 hours had taken a great deal of it, Rosie asked if she could spend the night at Daughters and Sisters.
"Quite a bit longer than that, if you need to," Anna replied. "Technically speaking, this is a shelter, a privately endowed halfway house. You can stay up to 8 weeks, and even that is an arbitrary number. We are quite flexible here at Daughters and Sisters." She preened slightly, and probably unconsciously, as she said this, and Rosie found herself remembering something she had learned about 1,000 years ago, in French too. L'état, c'est moi. Then the thought was swept away by amazement as she really realized what the woman was saying. Eight. She thought of the pale young man who had been sitting outside the entrance to the port side terminal, the one with a sign in his lap reading homeless and have AIDS, and suddenly knew how he would feel if a passing stranger for some reason dropped a $100 bill into his cigar box.
"Pardon me, did you say up to 8 weeks?"
"Dig out your ears, little lady," Anna Stevenson would say briskly. "Days, I said 8 days. Do you think we'd let the likes of you stay here for 8 weeks? Let's be sensible, shall we?"
Instead, Anna nodded.
"Although very few of the women who come to us end up having to stay so long, that's a point of pride with us. And you'll eventually pay for your room and board, although we like to think the prices here are very reasonable." She smiled that brief, preening smile again. "You should be aware that the accommodations are a long way from fancy. Most of the second floor has been turned into a dormitory. There are 30 beds, well, cots, and one of them just happens to be vacant, which is why we were able to take you in. The room you slept in today belongs to one of the live-in counselors. We have 3.
"Don't you have to ask someone?" Rosie whispered. "Put my name up before a committee or something."
"I'm the committee," Anna replied, and Rosie later thought that it had probably been years since the woman had heard the faint arrogance in her own voice. "Daughters and Sisters was set up by my parents, who were well-to-do. There's a very helpful, endowed trust. I choose who's invited to stay and who isn't invited to stay, although the reactions of the other women to potential DNS candidates are important. Crucial, maybe. Their reaction to you was favorable."
"That's good, isn't it?" Rosie asked faintly.
"Yes, indeed." Anna rummaged on her desk, moved documents, and finally found what she wanted behind the PowerBook computer sitting to her left. She flapped a sheet of paper with a blue Daughters and Sisters letterhead at Rosie. "Here, read this and sign it. Basically, it says that you agree to pay $16 a night, room and board, payment to be deferred if necessary. It's not even really legal, just a promise. We like it if you can pay half as you go, at least for a while."
"I can," Rosie said. "I still have some money. I don't know how to thank you for this, Mrs. Stevenson."
"It's Ms. to my business associates and Anna to you," she said, watching Rosie scribble her name on the bottom of the sheet. "And you don't need to thank me, or Peter Slowick either. It was Providence that brought you here, Providence with a capital P, just like in a Charles Dickens novel. I really believe that. I've seen too many women crawl in here broken and walk out whole not to believe it. Peter is one of 2 dozen people in the city who refer women to me. But the force that brought you to him, Rose, that was Providence."
"With a capital P."
"Correct." Anna glanced at Rosie's signature, then placed the paper on a shelf to her right, where Rosie felt sure it would disappear into the general clutter before another 24 hours had passed. "Now," Anna said, speaking with the air of someone who is finished with the boring formalities and may now get down to what she really likes, "what can you do?"
"Do?" Rosie echoed. She suddenly felt faint again. She knew what was coming.
"Yes, do. What can you do?
Any shorthand skills, for instance?
She swallowed. She had taken shorthand 1 and 2 back at Aubreyville High, and she had gotten A's in both. But these days she wouldn't know a pothook from a boathook. She shook her head. No shorthand. Once, but no more.
Any other secretarial skills?
She shook her head. Warm prickles stung at her eyes. She blinked them back savagely. The knuckles of her interlocked hands were gleaming white again.
Clerical skills? Typing, maybe?
No.
Math? Counting? Banking?
No.
Anna Stevenson happened on a pencil amid the heaps of paper, extracted it, and tapped the eraser end against her clean white teeth. Can you waitress?
Rosie desperately wanted to say yes, but she thought about the large trays waitresses had to balance all day long, and then she thought about her back and her kidneys.
No,
she whispered. She was losing her battle with the tears. The little room and the woman on the other side of the desk began to blur and soften.
Not yet, anyway. Maybe in a month or two. My back. Right now it's not strong.
And oh, it sounded like a lie. It was the kind of thing that, when he heard someone say it on TV, made Norman laugh cynically and talk about welfare Cadillacs and food stamp millionaires. Anna Stevenson did not seem particularly perturbed, however.
What skills do you have, Rose? Any at all?
Yes, she said, appalled by the harsh, angry edge she heard in her voice, but unable to make it go away or even mute it. Yes, indeed, I can dust, I can wash dishes, I can make beds, I can vacuum the floor, I can cook meals for two, I can sleep with my husband once a week, and I can take a punch. That's another skill I have. Do you suppose any of the local gyms have openings for sparring partners?
Then she did burst into tears. She wept into her cupped hands as she had so often during the years since she had married him, wept and waited for Anna to tell her to get out, that they could fill the empty cot upstairs with someone who wasn't a smartass. Something bumped the back of her left hand. She lowered it and saw a box of Kleenex. Anna Stevenson was holding it out to her. And, incredibly, Anna Stevenson was smiling.
I don't think you'll have to be anyone's sparring partner, she said. Things are going to work out for you, I think. They almost always do. Here, dry your eyes. And as Rosie dried them, Anna explained about the Whitestone Hotel, with which daughters and sisters had had a long and useful relationship. The Whitestone was owned by a corporation on whose board Anna's well-to-do father had once sat, and a great many women had relearned the satisfactions of working for pay there. Anna told Rosie that she would have to work only as hard as her back allowed her to work, and that if her overall physical condition didn't begin to improve in 21 days, she would be hauled off the job and taken to a hospital for tests. Also, you'll be paired with a woman who knows the ropes, a sort of counselor who lives here full-time. She'll teach you, and she'll be responsible for you. If you steal something, it'll be her who gets in trouble, not you. But you're not a thief, are you? Rosie shook her head.
Just my husband's bank card, that's all. And I only used it once, to make sure I could get away.
You'll work at the Whitestone until you find something that suits you better, as you almost certainly will. Providence, remember?
With a capital P.
Yes. While you're at the Whitestone, we ask only that you do your best. In order to protect the jobs of all the other women who'll come after you, if for no other reason. You follow me?
Rosie nodded.
Don't spoil it for the next person.
Don't spoil it for the next person, just so. It's good to have you here, Rose McClendon.
Anna stood up and extended both hands in a gesture which held more than a little of the unconscious arrogance Rosie had already sensed in her. Rosie hesitated, then stood and took the offered hands. Now their fingers were linked above the clutter of the desk.
I have 3 more things to tell you, Anna said. They're important, so I want you to clear your mind and listen carefully. Will you do that?
Yes, Rosie said. She was fascinated by Anna Stevenson's clear blue gaze.
First, taking the bank card doesn't make you a thief. That was your money as well as his. Second, there's nothing illegal about resuming your maiden name. It will belong to you your whole life. Third, you can be free if you want to. She paused, looking at Rosie with her remarkable blue eyes from above their clasped hands. Do you understand me? You can be free if you want to. Free of his hands, free of his ideas, free of him. Do you want that? To be free?
Yes, Rosie said in a low, wavering voice.